Our second lesson this morning is from Romans chapter 16, verses 1 through 16. And you'll quickly see that's a long list of some very unfamiliar names. Now, in Dwight Eisenhower's, one of his biographies, it was revealed that when he was growing up, the family was expected to read through the Bible each year, but they were always allowed to skip the genealogies. So they almost certainly skipped Romans 16. It may not be a list of genealogies, but it's a list of some unfamiliar names. But we can learn a lot from names. And whenever we have a letter in the New Testament, it's kind of like eavesdropping on one half of a conversation. We don't know what the other people were saying, what they were asking ahead of time, or what questions they may have had after the letter was read. But here in Romans 16, we have some clues as to who these early Roman Christians were. And we get those clues from their names. And so this is Romans 16, starting at verse 1. Paul writes, "I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church at Cenchrea, so that you may welcome her in the Lord as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require from you, for she has been a benefactor of many and of myself as well. Greet Prisca and Aquila, my co-workers in Christ Jesus, who risked their necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Greet also the church in their house. Greet my beloved Epaphras, who is the first convert in Asia for Christ. Greet Mary, who has worked very hard for you. Greet Andronicus and Junia, my fellow Israelites who were in prison with me. They are prominent among the apostles, and they were in Christ before I was. Greet Ampliatus, my beloved in the Lord. Greet Urbanus, our co-worker in Christ, and my beloved Stachys. Greet Apelles, who is approved in Christ. Greet those who belong to the family of Aristobulus. Greet my fellow Israelite Herodian. Greet those in the Lord who belong to the family of Narcissus. Greet those workers in the Lord, Tryphena and Tryphosa. Greet the beloved Persis, who has worked hard in the Lord. Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and greet his mother, a mother to me also. Greet Asyncritus, Phlegon, Hermes, Patrobus, Hermas, and the brothers and sisters who are with them. Greet Philologus, Julia, Nereus, and his sister, and Olympus, and all the saints who are with them. Greet one another with a holy kiss. All the churches of Christ greet you." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. A question for you this morning. Do you have hope? With everything going on in your life right now, with all that may or may not be overwhelming you at the moment, do you have hope? As you watch and listen to the news of the day, do you have hope? As you read about or hear a commentator speaking about the economy, the environment, healthcare, education, the never-ending election cycle, do you find reasons to hope? As you mentally travel around the globe and call to mind those places that have almost become synonymous with strife, Iran, Gaza, Ukraine, the Sudan. Do you find reasons for hope? In Wendell Berry's novel, Jay Bear Crow, Jay Bear observes that there is no new war, just the old one come again. Nonetheless, do you have hope? Do you have hope that one day we will see our way out of all these endless conflicts, that we will somehow get beyond the senseless violence? Do you have hope? As I said at the beginning of worship today, we begin a new series on the book of Romans. And a major theme throughout the letter of Romans is hope. But precisely how this hope is described might come across as a surprise. Now, first, I invite you to imagine a scene. It's a scene suggested by Beverly Roberts Gaventa, a New Testament scholar who's recently retired, in her book, When in Romans, An Invitation to Linger with the Gospel According to Paul. And I need to acknowledge that I've relied heavily on this book and on her commentary on the book of Romans as I prepared this series. Here is the scene. There is a woman named Phoebe reading a letter out loud. As I shared with the children, the Apostle Paul dictated the letter. A scribe named Tertius wrote down everything in very itsy-bitsy tiny letters. But it was Phoebe who read the letter. And if you've tried to read through Romans yourself, you may or may not have been able to read far enough along to learn about Phoebe. After all, you would have had to make it all the way to chapter 16, because that's when Phoebe first shows up. But here in 16 verses 1 and 2, Paul writes a little commendation for Phoebe. He identifies her as a deacon of the church of Cenchrea, which is part of the port of Corinth, as a benefactor to himself and to others. Now, this suggests that Phoebe has some resources at her disposal, since a benefactor is not simply a nice Christian lady, but someone in a position to support Paul's work. She clearly has the means to travel. Indeed, it appears she journeys to Rome as Paul's advance team, because Paul has not yet been to Rome. And once she arrives in Rome, she makes her way to the Trastevere quarter. In modern day, the Trastevere is a charming bohemian neighborhood known for its cobblestone streets, ivy-covered buildings, and bustling nightlife. In the first century, the Trastevere was populated largely by immigrants from the eastern part of the Roman Empire, places like Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, immigrants who arrived in Rome as enslaved persons, or maybe the children of enslaved persons. They worked along the harbor. They were brickmakers, cabinet makers, millers, potters. Many were desperately poor. And how do we know much of this? Well, partly due to the list of names that we read in Romans 16. Many of those names are Greek names or names that were from the eastern part of the empire. Seven of those names were women's names, which shows you that women were very important in the early ministry of Paul. Tryphona and Tryphosa were a pair of women who worked as a missionary couple. And again, many of the names also were names that were typically given to enslaved persons. And so there could have been many people who were still enslaved within this congregation of Roman Christians, or at the very least, people who had formerly been enslaved. But Phoebe gathers with them, and she gathers with various small groups of believers in different homes. She brings greetings from Paul, maybe even shows them a brief letter of recommendation. And then she settles in to read this long letter that Paul has sent. And so there, competing with the noises from the street, the cries of babies, the stench of too many bodies and too little hygiene, the moaning of the sick, Phoebe begins to read about Paul's letter to the Romans. As she reads, of course, she is interpreting the letter. Maybe she adds a word here and there to help explain things. At the very least, she's interpreting it by her inflection, her tone of voice, and she probably discusses it afterwards, occasionally adding points that she may remember from her own conversations with Paul. And this makes Phoebe the first interpreter of the book of Romans in a long line of interpreters, even before Origen's commentary on Romans, or Chrysostom, or Luther, or Calvin, or Karl Barth. The very first commentary on the book of Romans was by the deacon Phoebe. Unfortunately, we don't have a transcript of what she said. But nonetheless, she was the first one to read the letter and the first one to interpret it. And so try to picture her. Try to picture her reading to this group of Christians, immigrants, many of them poor, in the Trastevere quarter. And as Phoebe was reading the letter, do you think that she had hope? Do you think that she conveyed hope? And come to think of it, did Paul have hope? when Paul was dictating the letter to Tertius, did he feel hopeful? In some of the other letters in the New Testament, Paul specifically mentions his own hopes more often than he does in Romans. And so did Paul have hope? Paul does mention hope several times in the book of Romans, though again, he doesn't always say whether he himself had that hope. But like in Romans 5, he talks about boasting and sufferings. And he's certainly reading, Phoebe is certainly reading to a bunch of people who have known suffering. Knowing that suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint. We may wonder if that's always true. Is that something we're always willing to say? Or, as one person cynically pointed out, would we rather say that suffering produces bitterness, bitterness produces cynicism, and cynicism produces despair? And I'm not just being flippant here. If anything, asking hard questions like this prevents the book of Romans from becoming kind of a platitude, where someone just breezily says, quoting from Romans 8, that all things work together for good. And yet, even a deeper reading of that verse shows that, no, not everything is good. But somehow, in everything, God is working for the good. And so whatever hope Paul is writing about in Romans, it's not an easy, breezy, don't worry about it kind of hope. It would have to be a resilient hope. It would have to be a nonetheless kind of hope, or a nevertheless kind of hope, not ignoring the sufferings of the present moment, but very much taking them into account, and still nonetheless asserting that there's hope. And then in Romans 8:24, Paul says that we are saved by hope. And according to Beverly Gaventa, hope is itself the first fruit, the first tantalizing little nibble, if you will, of the arrival of God's final triumph. And in this sense, the whole second half of Romans chapter 8 is suffused with hope. Indeed, the sufferings of the present time are not to be compared with the glory that is just now about to be revealed to us. And Paul uses this imagery, saying that all of creation leans forward in anticipating what God is doing and will finally bring about. And even in the midst of the hunger and the danger, feelings of abandonment, God has already made known God's final triumph, so that God's enemies do not have the last word. Now, admittedly, this way of thinking about hope is not really a part of our culture so much. Hope for Paul is not a function of brain chemistry. It's not a human virtue. It's not a human virtue to be cultivated. Hope, instead, is something that God is doing, something that God has. And I find this to be good news because our own hopes tend to be a bit up and down, depending on our circumstances, depending on how we might be feeling at the moment. And so then, according to Paul, the most important thing about hope is not necessarily whether you or I have hope in any given moment, but that it's God's hope, it's God's future. And however wondrously and graciously it is for us, it is not about us. And so as we study Romans in the next few weeks, I invite you to view it through that lens. Think about hope as God's hope for you and I. Think about it as God's hope for the world, even with everything that is happening right now, but God's ultimate hope for the world. and we'll explore that more in recent weeks. And this morning, I'd like to invite you to think about the people in your life who have inspired you to have hope. Because you see, for Paul, that long list of names in Romans 16 is not just a list. It's a list of people that he may have met in earlier places, people that he met in the East who then later immigrated themselves to Rome. It could be people that he knows of by reputation. But they're people that Paul is eager for the listeners to greet, to acknowledge, probably because they've inspired hope. They've inspired Paul to have hope. They've inspired others to have hope. So it's not just a list of names. It's a list of people who have been inspirational. So who are those who have inspired you to hope? A parent, grandparent, a coach or teacher who never gave up on you. A neighbor who may or may not even realize that they did inspire you, but there was just something about them, something about how they approached life, how they didn't give in to despair, but they were just suffused with hope themselves. Who are the people in your life who have inspired you to have? There's a list in your bulletin. I invite you to spend a few moments. You can write out names in your bulletin if you like, or you can simply think about and give thanks to some of the people who inspired you to have hope. I invite us to do this for a couple of minutes before we have our next hymn. One of the names on my list is Jose Antonio. I met him in Nicaragua when a group from my seminary was traveling there, and we happened to be going through northwestern Nicaragua about 6 weeks after Hurricane Mitch had dumped half the ocean on top of Nicaragua and caused an extinct volcano to completely collapse, washing away a whole village in the aftermath. Jose Antonio had lost everything, including all of the members of his family. He searched for them for weeks and didn't find them. And Jose Antonio told us as a group, "No tengo ningún consuelo que Dios. I have no consolation but God." But there was something about how he said it. And granted, I'm an English speaker, Spanish is not my first language, but I still thought I could infer this from how he said it. To me, it didn't seem like he was saying it to engender pity, or like, "Look, my situation is so horrible, I can't even begin to tell you." Not like that. The way he said, "I have no consolation but God," was to suggest that somehow that was all he needed. That because his consolation was in God, it would somehow be enough. Not that that erases the grief or sweeps it aside, but for him saying, "I have no consolation but God," were words of hope. If you feel comfortable sharing some of the names on your list, I'd love to hear those stories, not just sharing them with me, but sharing them with others. But who are the people who said or did something that helped inspire hope?